Prime Minister humbled in Parliament provided little confidence that she could carry on. James Hippie, a minister for the armed forces, said Liz Truss, his boss, could not afford to make any more mistakes. Truss spoke to her Brexit-supporting lawmakers on Tuesday, promising to resolve the contentious rules that govern trade with Northern Ireland, and said she was still a low-tax conservative who would pursue such goals more slowly. One of those present said she was received warmly, in contrast to more hostile receptions from other wings of the party. Members of Parliament have been urged by government to hold off from any move to oust her before it presents its medium-term fiscal plan on 31st of October. Liz Truss was elected by Conservative Party members, not the broader electorate, on a promise to slash taxes and regulation to fire up the economy, in a policy dubbed by critics as a return to 1980s Thatcherite-style trickle-down economics. But markets reacted so dramatically that borrowing costs surged, lenders pulled mortgage offers, and pension funds fell into a tailspin.
Turkmans in Iran. Years have passed since the day Agha Mohammad Khan Qajar designated Tehran as the capital of Iran. During the past 251 years, the population of the city has grown day by day. Besides me, there are 12,399,999 other people who reside in Tehran. For various reasons, Tehran has been the destination for many migrating ethnicities in different eras. Turks, Lors, Kurds, Baluchis, Arabs, Fars, Shias, Sunnis, Jews, Armenians, Zoroastrians, and in short, hundreds of customs and traditions and millions of views are living side by side in this metropolitan city of 13 million people. The interesting thing is these ethnicities still have their own traditions even after so many years of living in Tehran. For example, the Turkmens, they've been seen on many occasions in different parts of the city. They resemble the people in East Asia, and their special costumes have always caught my attention. I wonder how they've managed to preserve their own authenticity among the myriad of different styles, or how they've managed to adapt themselves with this society, with this cultural and political structure where they are considered a minority group. Years ago, after the Safavid dynasty was toppled, Turkmens migrated to the lush green regions in northeastern Iran and settled down near Gorgan. The Turkmens were mostly nomads and would migrate to different parts in different seasons, but as time went by, they chose a different lifestyle, sedentism. The main population of Turkmens is concentrated in Turkmenistan, but you can find other clans of Turkmens in other countries like Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. The Turkmens in Iran are divided in three main clans, namely the Tekes, the Gukhlans, and Yomuts. Each of these clans is comprised of different ethnicities. The population of Turkmens in Iran is about 2 million people. Many big cities are known for the people in the world with symbols. For example, the Eiffel Tower in Paris, France, or the Statue of Liberty in New York, the U.S., or Burj al Arab in Dubai, or our own Siyosipol in Isfahan. and this is Wombat. Gumbad is a 60-meter tower made with bricks. For the existence of the very tower, the city was named Gumbad Qavus. The majority of the people in the city are Sunni Muslims and Turkmens. Color, color, and yet more color. It seems the people here love colors. You can see any color you've seen in nature on the clothes of the Turkmen people. Red, green, yellow, blue. Thanks to the colors, people look fresh. Wherever in the city I went, I only saw the smiles on the people's faces. The Turkmens who follow Hanafiism as their faith do not usually save their money. The important thing for them is to live a better life and enjoy the money they earn. They take advantage of the smallest opportunities to be happy. They're very friendly and real believers. When it comes to religious obligations, they're very committed people. Almost all Turkmens in Iran are Hanafis. Hanafism is one of the branches of Sunniism in Islam. The denomination has the largest number of followers among the four sects of Sunnis. Anyone can easily find these facts on the internet. I was looking for something else. I was looking for life. I really wanted to know how the Hanafis in northeastern Iran, or I'd better say the Turkmens, live. How did they manage to fend for themselves in Iran, where the majority of people are Shias? That's why I traveled to Gumbad Qavus and the adjacent cities several times. I got to know many people. One of those people was Mr. Niazi. He became the subject of my documentary. I'll start with my latest trip, in March, when Mr. Niazi had just come back from the Hajj pilgrimage. As the Hanafi Turkmens are considered a minority in Iran, the Shias residing in this region are also considered a minority. But the Shia and Sunni Turkmens have managed to come up with a rule after years of coexistence, and that is respecting one another's beliefs. For example, here. This place is Imamzadeh Yahya's shrine. Imamzadeh Yahya was one of the descendants of Imam Ali. It is a pilgrimage site for the Shia minority in Gumbad Qavus, but it doesn't seem that it makes that much difference for the people in this region. I mean, the Shias and Sunnis stand behind the Zari, that's the lattice structure, in the shrine and ask Imamzadeh to fulfill their wishes. My last trip to the northeast of Iran, Mr. Niazi and I went somewhere that was really interesting to me, the Qalicheshan Seminary School. It's about 80 kilometers away from Gumbad Qavus. When I looked at the structure from a distance, it didn't seem to be something new for me. I had already seen similar structures in other parts of Iran, but there were two things that were very interesting. First, in most of the villages around Gumbad, there are similar mansions that are considered seminary schools in the villages. Secondly, the numbers and figures used in the structure. Every brick in this seminary school is laid based on some principles and accurate calculations. There are four minarets that are built to represent the four Sunni caliphs. There are 23 chambers that stand for the 23 years that it took for the Quran to be revealed. Each chamber has 6,236 bricks, representing the 6,236 holy verses of the Holy Quran. To reach the Grand Master's office, you have to go up 12 steps. The 12 steps are built with the 12 Shia Imams in mind. The mansion was constructed about 150 years ago by Mr. Qili Cheshan, an outstanding Sunni figure back then. In his trip to Mecca, Qili Cheshan was respected by the Ottoman government. The Ottoman ruler, as a respect for the Sunnis in the neighboring Shia country, offered him help. Qili Cheshan brought some architects to the region and paid the expenses for the construction of the mansion with the help of the Ottoman government in order to promote the Sunnis. A few years ago, a grand mosque was built next to the Qili Cheshan Seminary School. The mosque's capacity is more than the population of the village. A few kilometers away from the Qili Cheshan building, there is a city called Kalaleh. It has a seminary school as well. Quran recitation competitions are held on a monthly basis in this seminary. Every month, many Turkmen participants come here to take part in the competition and be judged by the Sunni masters. Mr. Niazi told me that many Quran reciters and memorizers find their ways to the national competitions through the competitions that are held rotationally every month in different parts of the regions. But as for the Turkman's livelihood, as I said, I went to one of the successful Turkman people, I mean Mr. Behruz Niazi. Mr. Behruz Niazi, unlike his family name, meaning a person who is in need, thanks to his years-long hard work and thank God, does not need worldly assets. He is one of the successful citizens of this city, Gonbat Kavus. He has three children, and during the couple of days I stayed with them, I realized that he cares a lot about his family and loves them tremendously. Iranians have some traditions. It has a special place among all of them, and it's really important to observe them, like respecting their elders, especially their parents, or observing the Nowruz traditions, or religious ceremonies, or traveling. Turkmans are no exception. They love to travel. If the travel is to God's house, it is of utmost significance. This is Mr. Niazi, the senior, the elder in the Niazi family. He's Behruz Niazi's father. When a Turkman goes back home from the Hajj pilgrimage, the relatives hold a ceremony that is very interesting. They shower the Hajj pilgrims with nokl candles and cash, just like a bride and groom. They welcome them warmly. Afterwards, the Haji gives the guests some water from the Zamzam well as a holy souvenir. They stand facing towards the Qibla in Mecca and make a wish and drink the water so they become blessed with the water from the Zamzam and their wishes will be fulfilled. In small and large cities, there must be some places to shore up the economy of the region. This is the beating heart of Gonbat Kavus's economy. An industrial township with 50 factories and workshops and 1,200 people who put food on the table by working in this place. In northeastern Iran, there are three dairy product factories that are modernized and facilitated with modern equipment. One of the factories belongs to Mr. Niazi, that is located in the industrial township. 250 people directly work in it. The capacity of the factory is about 100 tons of milk per day. The products are loaded onto about 60 trucks on a daily basis. In all mythical stories we've heard since we were children and have passed on from generation to generation until today, there's always been a champion, or I'd better say, a hero, who's risen up to defend the oppressed people and save them from the tyranny of an oppressive ruler. Besides their swords and shields, the heroes had something else that was among the main characters in the stories. I mean, a horse. This spacious stable belongs to Mr. Niazi, where about 30 horses are kept. Horses of renowned and good breed. Most of them are Turkmen. For example, Cobra, who's now become a little old. Some years ago, Cobra was among the winners of horse racing. Keeping these horses costs a lot, as well as purchasing them. They're bought at exorbitant prices. For example, this Australian giant. I didn't even dare get close to it. It seems only two or three people can ride it, and it doesn't like me that much. Turkmens have a good income through raising horses. There are 30 clubs and over 2,400 horses in Gombak Kavus. If each horse is valued at $40,000 only in the region of Turkmens, I mean northeast of Iran, the horses are worth $96,000. About noon that day, it was a Friday, we had the road to see another part of the city as well. I mean the Grand Mosque in Gombad. On our way to the Grand Mosque, I saw Sunni Turkmens who had put on their best clothes to join a spiritual gathering. The majority of the people in the city are Hanafi Sunnis. The Friday prayers in here, like other parts of Iran, are held very passionately. The prayers and the sermons by the Friday prayers leaders and the speeches by the guests were very interesting and effective. I said my prayers along with my Sunni brothers, alongside each other and facing towards the same Qibla. In northeastern Iran, a tribe lives that's known as Turkmen. They earn a living through hunting and raising cattle. Turkmen women and men are skillful horseback riders as well, who flaunt their skills with the purebred Turkmen horses on the green plains like the wind. These sentences are descriptions about the Turkmens in Iran, men and women who are fast horseback riders. This place is Gombad Kavus' horse racing track, a place that houses many horseback riders from all across the country and gathers everyone together. Like many big stadiums in the world, this place generates a lot of revenue. From the vendors to the horseback riders and the owners of the horses and the lucrative market of betting, the excitement in this place is indescribable. Women, men, young and old, get together in this place for their passions for the horses they somehow consider as theirs and hope their horses cross the finish line first. Up north, down south, back east, and out west of Iran are brimming with different cultures and traditions. The cultures that might be very different from each other, but they managed to live together for hundreds of years. Before packing up and moving towards Gombak Kavus, I was really worried. I was worried how I was going to come to terms with a completely different culture, or how a different culture could come to terms with a stranger like me. But after living with the Turkmans for 10 days, I managed to find many differences that did not exist between us. I managed to find many differences that don't exist between us. There's not much difference between me as a Shia who lives in Tehran and a Sunni person who lives in Gombak Kavus. We're both Muslims and pray facing towards the same Qibla, and we're both living in Iran, in a country like everywhere else in the world. The person who respects other people's beliefs achieves success and makes efforts to attain their goal. As a prominent Iranian poet, Saadi, says, "If you don't tolerate my pain, you won't get any treasure. He who worked got the wage."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Massive protests and strikes of French people against rising living costs was just partly covered in Western media, especially the French news outlets. However, some world media websites reported these demonstrations elaborately. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part. New York Times reported tens of thousands of people marched in Paris to protest rising living costs amid an increasingly tense political atmosphere marked by strikes at oil refineries and nuclear plants that threatened to spread further. The march had been planned long before the strikes by a coalition of left-wing parties eager to capitalize on the cost of living crisis and assert itself as the leading opposition force to President Emmanuel Macron. But recently, organizers signaled that they intended to build momentum from the climate of social unrest to increase pressure on Macron's government. "We need to be tougher," said David Girard, a lawmaker from France on BAUD, the hard left party that led the recent protest. He added that the government could no longer decide on its own. Macron finds himself in a perilous situation. He's simultaneously facing discontent over shortages at gas stations, along with labor strikes and a fierce opposition in the National Assembly, the lower and more powerful House of Parliament, which may try to bring down his government this week over a disputed budget bill. Jean-Luc Mélenchon said, "We are entering a particular and quiet extraordinary cycle." Jean-Luc Mélenchon is the leader of France on BAUD. As he led the protests recently, he noted the great convergence among the strikes, the crisis in Parliament, and the march. At the heart of the matter are rising living costs, already a key topic in this spring's French presidential campaign. It has now moved to the top of French people's concerns, according to a recent study, far ahead of more traditional issues like climate change, security or immigration. Though lower than in the rest of Europe, inflation in France has surpassed 6%, jacking up the prices of staples like meat and pasta. Parliament passed an inflation relief package this summer, but it has not completely offset soaring energy costs, which are rising because of Russia-Ukraine conflict. "It's unbelievable," said Guignola Leroux, a 63-year-old retired literature professor who marched recently, adding, "Every time I buy basic necessities, I wonder if they got the prices wrong." She was holding a covered sign on which she had written a fable inspired by the 17th century poet La Fontaine, denouncing the inflation. "Audio, water, lettuce, Sachsen, electricity," it read. The situation has been compounded by strikes at many refineries in France, which have left nearly a third of all gas pumps across the country fully or partly dry, and have forced drivers to line up for hours at stations, sometimes in chaotic scenes. Workers have been picketing for higher wages in line with inflation, as well as a greater share of the surging profits of energy giants. But their demands have resonated far beyond refineries, prompting nuclear plants and railroad workers to stop work as well, or plan to. The left has seemed eager to use the social unrest to bounce back politically from scandals involving domestic violence and harassment by prominent lawmakers. Members of France Unbowed have been trying to call the discontent with some traveling to strike sites in northern France to call for an amplification of the protest. You can count us at the National Assembly to echo these fights, to carry your voice, and to be at your side. Thomas Ports, another France Unbowed lawmaker, told the striking workers at Total Energy's refinery near Le Havre recently. Because of strategic disagreements, the main trade unions did not participate in the recent march. They have instead called for a general strike. Mr. Melanchon echoed that call, describing the situation as the emergence of a new popular front, a reference to the broad leftist coalition that rose to power in France during the interwar period. The march, which began at the Place de la Nation and ended at Place de la Bastille in eastern Paris, had all the hallmarks of a classic French leftist protest: a sea of red flags, anti-fascist slogans, and booths selling revolutionary essays.
Hidden Files. 40 acres and a mule. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He's an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then but that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country, in 1965 and the 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things were have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice. They've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African-Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being on within these boundaries. But African-Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparations. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the public policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory under international law to redress a situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity. Return or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. we're going to take a look at a few instances that have taken a place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And you know, the cotton actually built New York City as the commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable and make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote-unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as treated like domesticated animals. You know, so they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal. You know, even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans, and we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved. We were tortured. And to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote-unquote third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The crisis hit European Union, which is now desperate, has now resorted to its former colony, Algeria, to make a deal on gas. Whether it will be successful or not is a question which is answered in the opinion editorial published in Russia Today website. Stay with us for more of the opinion editorial of Russia Today. Faced with an energy crisis, France turns to a former colony that might not be too eager to rekindle an abusive relationship. Just a year ago, French President Emmanuel Macron could hardly bother to give the former North African French colony the time of day. It was mostly taken for granted that Algiers would keep pumping gas for the European Union as the bloc's third largest natural gas supplier after Russia and Norway. Emmanuel Macron even accused the country's political-military system of inciting hatred towards France. He went as far as to ask, was there an Algerian nation before French colonization? That's the question, he said. Sounds a lot like the rhetoric someone hears when they're in an exploitative relationship. You were nothing before I came along and started taking advantage of you. But now that the European Union is undergoing an acrimonious divorce from former natural gas main squeeze, Russia, its tune has surely changed. This week, the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, headed to Algeria with 16 French ministers for an economic cooperation trip. Increased gas supplies for France were not on the table, according to her office. Guess she is waiting until the third date, like a gentleman, before jumping all over Algeria's gas. But the moment could be coming up fast, since the country's first date with its new French charmers was with Emmanuel Macron himself just 6 weeks ago. He didn't mention gas at the time, but the fact that he showed up on the date with the chief executive officer of the Paris-headquartered energy multinational, Engie, hinted at his real interest. Similarly, the European Union Energy Commissioner was just expected to attend a conference in the country during the French delegation's trip. Officially, the French wooing of Algiers is all about reconciliation and making amends. Sorry, I ignored you and took advantage of your kindness earlier. How about giving me a chance? I've changed. Of course, Europe has indeed changed. It's now knocking on the doors worldwide in an effort to shake free from new gas supplies, and as its economy starts buckling under spiking energy prices, energy rationing, and blackout threats. And fall has barely even begun, let alone winter. For an idea of just how bad things are, last week, the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, held a press conference to introduce an energy sobriety plan for all sectors of French daily life, from businesses and sports to housing, industry and public services. Sobriety is a simple concept, savings chosen rather than cuts suffered, said Borne. Depending on our consumption and the weather, we will then know if we are progressing at the right pace and in the right direction. The French government, like others across Europe, has already set heating and cooling limits. In France, someone going over the 19 degrees Celsius temperature for their home could theoretically risk a €1,500 fine under the French Penal Code and €3,000 in the case of repeat offenders. But unfortunately for Europe, Algiers has long maintained an officially non-aligned position and doesn't sound too keen on throwing itself totally and exclusively into the arms of Europe and the West, particularly now that it has other options to diversify its interests in an increasingly multipolar world. To that end, it has strengthened bilateral cooperation with China and its historical ally Russia, which helped it gain its independence from France, as it has every right to do so. Further complicating France and the European Union's seduction efforts is its meddling stepmom, America, who doesn't like that Algeria has ties with Russia and seems to want to nip in the bud any deepening EU